Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show with your morning show host Julie Calamine and Phil Huff. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, Julie. How are you?
I'm fine. We are joined this morning by a very interesting guest. We haven't had anyone from this particular area of fish and game, although we have had a number of Idaho fish and game folks on. But today we're going to be talking about a really interesting and kind of fun topic, butterflies.
Monarch butterflies.
That's right. With having said that, I'd like to introduce our morning show guest, who is Beth Waterbury, a retired Idaho Fish and Game wildlife biologist. Good morning, Beth.
Good morning, Julie and Phil.
Welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yes, and as are we. I didn't mention it in the introduction, but we are recording, Beth, from a remote location in Salmon. We're here in Sandpoint, and Beth is in Salmon, so we're doing this over the phone, and we appreciate your willingness to call us on the phone and have an interview.
Sounds great. I wish I could be there.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, Beth, and how you became involved with monarch butterflies.
Sure. Well, I guess I've worked as a wildlife biologist across the West, starting with California Department of Fish and Game, way back in like 1985. I jumped the border and started working for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, worked in the Klamath Basin and Portland headquarters in the 1990s. So I came to Idaho in about 2001 as a probably what I would call a mature newlywed with my husband, who is also a wildlife biologist. We landed a couple of dream jobs in Salmon here. And so I have been here working as a wildlife diversity biologist for Idaho Fish and Game in the Salmon region for about 16 years, just recently retired about a month ago.
A month ago? That's
wow.
Very recent retirement.
Very recent, yes. I know, I still am kind of pinching myself a little bit about it. So but over here, I've been able to work on, you know, a wide range of wildlife with emphasis on what are called species of conservation concern and non-game species, which are basically species that are not hunted, fished, or trapped. Mm-hmm. And these species of conservation concern and non-game species, they make up about 10,000 species in Idaho, which is about 98% of, you know, the biodiversity in Idaho. And this includes invertebrates like the monarch butterfly to songbirds, bats, amphibians, reptiles, you know, on up to wolverines. So really, arguably, it's probably one of the best jobs in Idaho Fish and Game.
I should because, think so.
Yeah, just and because it just has this tremendously wide scope and you get this element of discovery in what we do. And opportunity to work on so many really cool critters
that we know
so little about.
That's right. And, you know, it's interesting because we think of the fish and game as the species that we do buy licenses for. And maybe that's where the funding comes from. I don't know. But it's such a small number of species compared to those that you all work on, isn't it?
It really is. And the funding source for the wildlife diversity program is very different from those that are supported by hunting licenses and tag fees. So our wildlife diversity program is funded by the tax checkoff. People might be familiar with that. Mm-hmm. It's funded by wildlife license plates and then contributions. So it doesn't come from hunting licenses or tag fees or fishing licenses or anything like that. So our budget is pretty modest. And so we end up, you know, doing a lot of grant application to kind of supplement our pretty small, modest budget.
So with such a wide range of non-game species to choose from, how did you come to work with the monarch butterfly?
Well, the monarch has been a pretty iconic species for me kind of throughout my life. It's kind of interesting to think about it. I feel like I've come full circle. So growing up in the Midwest, in Wisconsin and Illinois, I remember my parents every year would take us on day trips over to the Mississippi River. We would see the fall migration of monarchs. They would just come flooding through that area. And then we kids, we would just have a blast, you know, kind of blowing the milkweed puffs and fluff all over each other, that kind of a thing. And then, you know, fast forward like 20 years, I was an undergrad at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which is on the Central Coast.
Yes, I know. And I know what you're about to say. It's a wintering spot, isn't it?
Very good. It is. It's one of, you know, many overwintering sites for monarchs on the Central Coast of California. And I just felt like I lived close to monarchs for, you know, the 4 years I was there. And then, you know, another 30 years on from that, starting in 2014, I started looking at the status of monarchs in the salmon region here, and which is over east central Idaho. And I started doing an inventory project, inventorying milkweed, which is the monarch's host plant. This is the plant that monarchs lay their eggs on, and the young caterpillars hatch and feed on milkweed. They can't exist on any other food source. So I started doing this inventory, and much to my surprise, you know, that survey demonstrated that not only do monarchs indeed breed here in east central Idaho, but they breed at relatively, you know, high densities and high elevations, because we're at like 4,000 feet here, and they produce at least two generations during the summer months up here. So I started looking a little bit closer at monarch records in Idaho, and I was literally just floored that there were so few records in the state.
And Beth, give us a timeline of this. When did you start inventorying?
The first survey I did was in 2014, so not that many years ago. So when I started looking at the number of records for the entire state of Idaho, there were less than 10, you know, either historic records or more contemporary records, which was just crazy. It was crazy to me. I thought there would be a lot more. And some of these historic records were in the late 1800s or 1920s. And you know, contemporary records, like in the last 10, 20 years, there were maybe like two or three. So people may have been seeing monarchs, but they weren't reporting them. And we had no idea if they were just migrating through the state or if they were coming to Idaho to actually breed. Just had no idea. So just given that monarch breeding was confirmed here in the salmon region with, you know, we have a rather harsh climate and a short growing season. I just assumed, you know, and was guessing that monarchs must occur in other more suitable areas of the state. So that was my premise of the study that I proposed. And I ended up partnering with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and we each, as partners, conducted statewide surveys concurrently with another organization called the Xerces Society. That's Xerces with an X.
Yes.
And their full name is Xerces Society for Invertebrate Conservation.
Mm. Well, you've mentioned that the budget for these sorts of, you know, for your department is quite small. Was there additional funding for this?
We did. We applied under a grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who was also very interested in learning more about the status of monarchs in the West, which is basically, you know, a big question mark for most of the 11 Western states. And so with Ann Potter, my colleague in Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, we put in together for a grant and ended up getting about $150,000 to do a two-year study. And to that, we had to provide about a quarter of that in match, either kind of a cash funding or in-kind support.
So given the 4 years you've been studying and some access to historical records, how are the monarchs doing? What can you tell us?
Well, I can tell you that it's variable from year to year because when we did our actual study starting in 2016 and 2017, we had a couple of back-to-back good monarch production years in Idaho. If we were doing that study this year, I think we would have been very discouraged because we think, you know, the weather this particular year has really deterred monarch production in both Idaho and Washington. It's kind of what we're seeing. The one thing I would say, though, Phil, is that in the 2016-2017 timeframe, we found and documented like a lot of both milkweed and different species of milkweed and confirmed monarch breeding in most of the counties of each of our states. I should probably define the area we searched in Washington was only eastern Washington, because monarchs do not occur west of the Cascades in general.
So do you have enough information to give a sense of how well they're doing across Idaho or in our region?
I would say that in years where we have, you know, moderate summers where it's not incredibly hot, you know, like it is this year, we have good production going on. We are contributing, you know, a substantial number of monarchs to the Western population. And this was demonstrated in another study that was done in California by a gentleman named Louis Yang and his colleagues. They collected some monarchs at different overwintering sites on the California coast, and then they did what's called a stable isotope analysis, which allowed them to estimate the origin of those monarchs, where they were produced in the West. And what they found is that about 40% of those monarchs over on the coastal portion of California were produced in the Intermountain region, which includes Idaho and eastern Washington. So it tells you that, you know, there is a significant contribution there, something we had really no idea about as recently as, you know, 5 or 6 years ago.
So interesting. You know, I also grew up in the Midwest, and I would think of the monarchs flying, of course, down the middle of the U.S. and into Mexico. But they're two, if I understand it right, and maybe I don't, they're different populations, right? Our group from here flies over to the coast and south, and the ones from the Midwest just sort of fly north and south. Is that true?
That is true. With one little caveat. So there is, yes, that differentiation between the two populations. And so there's the eastern population, which is much more well-studied than the western population. It's been, you know, studied for, you know, probably 30, 40, 50 years or so. And so we know a lot about their migration patterns and timing and, you know, the different milkweed species that they use on the pathway, the different nectar species they use. And the bulk of that population, they migrate down to central Mexico in the state of Michoacán, which is not far from Mexico City. And they cluster into a few acres of these mature, they're called OML fir forests, up at about 6,000 foot elevation and overwinter there. And then basically west of the Continental Divide, we have monarchs that, you know, they spread out through that whole 11 western state area up into, you know, the Canadian border. And they migrate to as many as, you know, maybe 40 or 50 different overwintering sites on that Pacific coast. But there is evidence of intermixing between the two, particularly in that Mexican overwintering site. So some of our western population, rather than going westward to the Pacific coast, some of them are believed to just kind of continue south, you know, through Utah, Arizona, directly to Mexico. So probably a distance of close to, you know, 2,000 miles for a little insect that weighs about a half a gram.
Isn't that insane? That's amazing.
It is amazing.
I think we've got a pretty good fix on the winter. Now, tell us more about where the two populations disperse to in the summer. How far east is east?
Yes. So as far as east, they spread really as far as like Maine in the U.S. and even up into about the 50-degree latitude into Canada. So they'll get up into Quebec and Ontario and, you know, even Saskatchewan. And but the heart of their breeding area in the eastern population is what we would consider the Corn Belt. You know, so it's probably like Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, Nebraska, you know, in that area, Illinois as well. And that area is the central, you know, that's where we grow corn and soybeans anymore.
Yes.
And historically, there was, you know, just abundant milkweed in those farm fields. And milkweed tends to like that kind of farming disturbance, and so that tends to perpetuate the milkweed. But in recent years, there's been farming practices have really changed. Now there's kind of the genetically modified corn being planted, soybeans as well, that are what are called, you know, Roundup ready, or they're resistant to herbicides. So farmers can plant their corn, plant their soybeans, and then go through and spray out any weed or anything they consider a weed, and that has really decimated a lot of milkweed habitat in this heartland area.
Ah, it's very important because, of course, they need a place to eat, and then there are multiple generations of monarchs that have to work their way through the country, right?
That's right, and that's a just one of the most phenomenal, remarkable things about monarchs, and maybe something that, you know, people don't really understand, but monarchs have what I call kind of a relay system of, you know, reproduction. They, you know, when they are ready to migrate away from the overwintering areas, you know, they will probably breed fairly close to the wintering area, maybe in the, you know, March or so time frame. And then they will lay eggs on milkweeds fairly close to the overwintering area. Then that next generation, which takes about a month from the point of time they lay an egg to the time that the five different stages of caterpillars grow, to the time they pupate, and then, you know, with forming their chrysalis, and then they emerge from the chrysalis. That is about, you know, a little over maybe 36 days or so, like. And then they tend to migrate on, usually further north, searching for milkweed to, you know, produce another generation.
So their dependency on milkweed, it sounds like if that's all they feed on, they have to have it all along their route.
They do.
And And we can envision that broad spread of the plant in the north, but what confines them to such narrow spots for the overwintering? Is it more than just the milkweed?
Yes, actually, the overwintering sites, they're not dependent on milkweed there, but they are dependent on a particular type of overwintering structure. And the key aspects of that are it creates the trees that they roost in, they basically cluster in, they create a microclimate. And you have to consider that monarchs are really a tropical species. You know, they cannot withstand really cold temperatures. And so these trees are usually mature trees. They're a grove of trees that provide insulation from the elements, both the shade, from the wind, from salt spray, from, you know, all types of incursions of winter. And so, you know, those are definitely required, as well as they need, you know, a certain type of humidity as well. So once you start, you know, say the trees get, you know, old or insect eaten and they start falling away, you lose that insulating microclimate effect of the wintering area. So there's usually a natural senescence of trees over time. But if this happens quickly, like it is in some areas of California, where you have non-native trees as their overwintering site, like eucalyptus. Eucalyptus is so susceptible to diseases and pests because it's not a native. It's just not very, you know, long-lived in California. And so a lot of these overwintering sites are really starting to lose their quality of habitat for monarchs. And they're not being replaced. And that is, you know, one of the concerns about the population declines that we're seeing.
I think the idea of the interconnection of the relationships is so fascinating. I've got to ask, the monarchs are dependent on the milkweed. Is the milkweed somehow dependent on the monarch, or does it have other relationships that it doesn't need the monarch as much?
You know, that is such a great question. And as far as, you know, the real monarch milkweed scientists and researchers have found, there isn't an obligate relationship from the milkweed, you know, to the monarch, other than, you know, the service of pollination. And pollination is extremely important because you need, you know, the adult monarchs are the ones that actually pollinate as they're sipping nectar from the milkweed flowers, which they love. They do tend to pollinate the milkweeds.
So the milkweed might have other suitors, but it does especially well with the monarchs.
Yes, absolutely. They are. They're so well in tune. And from what we saw here in Idaho, the species of milkweeds here provide a very, very important source of nectar for the adult monarchs, both during the breeding season and during that migratory season in both spring and fall.
Phil, it sounds like a country song in the making.
I know.
The monarch loves the milkweed loves the monarch, but maybe the
milkweed just chases around town.
That's right.
Right.
Well, let's bring it a little more, let's try and bring it in a little more locally. As you mentioned, you've worked with Eastern Washington and then throughout Idaho, and why don't you tell us more about what you learned up in this part of the state?
Sure. What we found up in the Panhandle area, happily we found two different species of native milkweeds in that area. There is one called a showy milkweed, which is probably the most common milkweed to the state of Idaho and probably the one that is used most by monarchs for breeding habitat. And the other species is called narrowleaf milkweed, and we found that in just impressive concentrations along the Spokane River, you know, kind of going through Post Falls and then on into towards Spokane. But that is it's kind of a unique and less common milkweed, but very desirable for monarchs. So having more than one species of milkweed in an area kind of doubles your, you know, your ability to support breeding monarchs, and especially if those two milkweeds have different, what I would call phenology, which is basically the timing of their growth cycle through the, you know, growing period. So showy milkweed tends to, you know, kind of sprout up really early, and it's available for those that first generation of monarchs that migrate into Idaho, usually around the first week of June. And the narrowleaf milkweed is a later phenology. So once the showy starts petering out a little bit, maybe stops blooming, starts to fruit, then you have the narrowleaf milkweed coming into bloom. So it provides a longer period for them to lay eggs, you know, another generation, or to as a nectar resource for the adults. So that's one great thing about the panhandle. And the other is that, you know, the areas around what I would call the Rathdrum Prairie and most any, you know, of the land that is kind of in agricultural country in that area is highly suitable for growing milkweed. Mm-hmm. The thing is, the milkweed that's up there is, most of it is along, like, road cuts and in areas where it's a little vulnerable to, you know, maybe weed spraying, things like that. So the opportunity to kind of increase the availability of milkweed in that area, but on areas away from roadsides, away from maybe railroad, you know, right-of-ways, where they, you know, they have to keep weeds down, and they spray kind of indiscriminately. They don't really spot spray, you know, to kind of keep the milkweed, which I wish they would do, but it, you know, they don't, and they can't to a certain degree. So, you know, getting milkweed established in some of that habitat would be an amazing attractant to even more monarchs up in the panhandle area.
It sounds like there's a lot of work to be done. Are there other habitat improvement proposals, projects going on?
Well, I know that there are a few people working up in the panhandle that are definitely looking to increase pollinator habitat, including habitat for monarchs, so by planting milkweed. I know the city of Rathdrum just recently became the first city in Idaho designated as a Monarch City USA.
I saw that. I was impressed that they had accomplished that.
That is so cool. That, you know, that tells you that, you know, city management, city leaders, as well as local citizens are supportive of, you know, projects that are going to improve the situation for monarchs,
yes,
and pollinators.
And so Beth, you mentioned that your study was an inventory of habitats and monarchs, but was it also a habitat? Were you involved in adding habitat, or was that not part of your study?
Well, our survey was really focused primarily on understanding the distribution of milkweed first, because that's what monarchs rely on, and then second, where in the landscape are monarchs breeding?
Yes.
In that milkweed habitat matrix. And so that the question that you're asking about, you know, the habitat enhancement angle of it, we contributed all of our data, all of our location data, to an effort by a couple of gentlemen that work out of the University of Nevada in Reno, a gentleman named Tom Diltz and Matt Forrester. And they developed an improved habitat suitability map for monarchs and for different species of milkweeds for all of the West, including Idaho. So what that does is it focuses in on the best, type of habitat and where that occurs in the state to do these conservation projects. Because you know, funding is limited, because, like, milkweed seed is a limited resource, you want to be able to, you know, kind of
make the most of it.
Implement a project where it's going to be most successful. And so kind of pinpointing where those areas are in the state of Idaho was part of our objective. But the actual getting out there and doing the enhancement work, this is kind of the next step.
So part of your work, or part of the ongoing work, or both, has involved citizen scientists. Can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. Citizen scientists are just an incredible resource, not only to monarchs, which is, you know, proven by their work in, you know, several projects that primarily cover eastern U.S. population, but are spreading throughout the western population. So there are a lot of online reporting websites out there that citizen scientists contribute to. And one of those is like Journey North, which is an online website that helps, everybody kind of track the migration of monarchs as they move northward and as they, you know, migrate back to overwintering sites. Through our Washington and Idaho project that we just did, we worked with Xerces Society to develop a new website called the Western Monarch Milkweed Mapper. It's a mouthful there, but and I encourage people, you know, just kind of go to Mr. Google and, you know, type in Western Monarch Milkweed Mapper, and it'll take you to a very informative website where citizen scientists can, you know, they can upload any observations they have of monarchs or milkweeds. They can, all of that data is downloadable, searchable. They can learn about the different species of milkweeds that occur in the West, and they can look at a map of the distribution that has filled in incredibly in the last few years because of not only our project, but what the citizen scientists are contributing.
There's so much great work that can go on with citizen science that contribute to the knowledge, and also they can learn so much too. For our listeners who aren't regularly tuned in, tell a little bit about the Xerces Society.
Yes, well, the Xerces Society is it's based out of Portland, Oregon, and they are dedicated to the conservation of all native invertebrates. They're probably hands down the best resource for all sorts of information on not only monarchs. They've been working, decades on monarch conservation issues, but very rare, you know, even more rare butterflies or, moths, grasshoppers, you know, just all sorts of invertebrates. Even think like freshwater mussels. They cover a range of different invertebrates. And They have, you know, if you're interested in bumblebees, they have an incredible resource online of different publications that people can, you know, easily research, download, and you know, use to learn what can I do to conserve bumblebees in my backyard or in my community. And I would say for the monarch, they've got some incredible resources on there's a pamphlet, a series of pamphlets that they have that are called Monarch Nectar Plants of, you know, the Inland Northwest, or, you know, another area of the state or in the Pacific Northwest. And these are very, very helpful for people that want to, you know, plant up their gardens with different, you know, perennials or blooming plants that will support a range of different pollinators, including the monarch.
Yes, and you're headed in the direction I was just thinking about. And, of course, mm-hmm. Listeners here in the Idaho Panhandle and also eastern Idaho might be eastern Washington might also be uh-huh. thinking about what might they be able to do to help these lovely monarchs on their migration. And it does sound like monarchs are the milkweeds are the key, but it sounds like there might be some other plants as well. And you know, we might be looking for sources for that milkweed too.
Right. So, Julie, you've really hit a key part of what's really different between the eastern and western populations is, you know, that nectar resource component on the landscape. If you think of the eastern population, the precipitation pattern in the east is virtually the doppelganger of ours in the West, because they get all of their precipitation in the summertime. And, you know, so that ends up, you know, creating a really good situation for all sorts of nectar plants and availability of nectar plants growing into the fall during the migration. So in the West, we're kind of, you know, that opposite of that. And we tend to have, you know, wet winters, maybe a wet spring, and then we're dry until, you know, October. And by that time, all the monarchs are over on the coast again. So we have an issue in the West of very few nectar resources being on the landscape during that critical, you know, fall migration period. So I guess, you know, if people could plant up, you know, blooming, flowering plants that are available, you know, well into August, September, even October in some of the points furthest south in the state, that will really help to kind of, you know, get monarchs through a pretty difficult migration through eastern Washington, through portions of Nevada, maybe parts of Utah that are just high and dry. You know?
Yes, it sounds like a tough migration in that time of the year for these butterflies. And
it
I can
is.
Imagine
and
them going over the mountains too. That can't be fun.
Agreed. But in the mountains, they may find more nectar resources because there's a little bit more moisture. It holds on a little bit longer in certain areas. So anyway, the nectar resource really can't be understated. And even though we don't have a lot of research yet in the West on that aspect of their habitat need, it's pretty apparent to us that is a critical resource that is kind of lacking in the West and maybe influencing their fitness once they get down to the overwintering area, where they need to, on their migration, store up and kind of accumulate lipids to carry them through, 4 to 5 months for that one generation. So Sorry, my phone's ringing.
Oh, we forgot to mention, turn off your phone.
Bad girl. Okay.
There's so much to learn and so much to know about them. And obviously, for the researchers, way much more. But for the person who's just tuning into the world of the outdoors and thinking, what a neat thing to learn about, where would a beginner go to find out the fundamentals about the monarch butterfly?
Well, I would say, you know, a great place to go for the basics on their, you know, their biology and their life history would be going to either the Xerces Society website, which is, I think their website is www.xerces.com.
And spell Xerces for us?
Yes, X-E-R-C-E-S.
Thank you.
Yeah. And it's I think they're named after the Xerces butterfly, which is now an extinct butterfly. But that was kind of their inspiration for starting the organization.
And here in Idaho, around the state, there are a number of chapters of the Idaho Master Naturalists. Here locally, we have one, and they often do educational programs. They're a good resource.
They are. They're great. We have several chapters of Master Naturalists throughout Idaho. And the Sandpoint chapter and other chapters around the state were very instrumental in helping us during the 2016 portion of our survey. They were on the ground helping us actually survey, particular sites. They helped us with some of the monarch tagging, which I haven't talked about yet, but it is kind of a fun thing. And they were the primary folks that attended a series of workshops that we provided in 2016 and 2017 that were just basically to introduce, citizen scientists to monarch biology and conservation.
As we are nearing the end of our interview, but I've got to hear a bit about the monarch tagging. It sounds like an impossibly delicate procedure.
Yes, it's so much fun. I highly recommend it to anybody that has the correct equipment and maybe has someone with a little experience to kind of guide them through. But so what we usually do is we get a group of folks. It's always more fun with more people. You get some good butterfly nets, and we get our little tags, which are, you know, probably about a quarter inch in diameter. They're round, white adhesive on one side, and then they have a letter code on one side with a little notation of an email address to Washington State University and Dr. David James, Pacific Butterflies of the Northwest Project. So he has a great Facebook site. Again, if someone were to, search for Dr. David James, they'll get to that Facebook page. It's wonderful.
It sounds like a great resource.
Yes, he's another really good resource. And then what we do is we, as butterflies are kind of congregating, getting ready for migration, we will go out and gently net butterflies and get them in hand. And we take one of the tags, one of these little adhesive tags, and there's a very particular point on monarch wing that you place that tag so that it doesn't confound their flight or their balance as they're flying. And it's on the underside of the wing. And it's called the discal cell, it's kind of this mitten-shaped cell, fairly close to the body. And so when the monarch alights on a flower to nectar, that tag sticks out like a sore thumb. You know, it's just very, very bright. But it counts on people along the migration path being on the lookout for them. and then finding them, and then getting close enough to be able to detect the code.
Yes, it doesn't sound that yes. easy, but nonetheless, maybe
easy.
Worth it.
Yes. So, yes. I mean, it does, you know, it's successful on a very small percent of actual tagged monarchs. And until such time we can develop, you know, a transmitter tiny enough for something, again, that weighs less than a gram.
Yes.
You know, well, that's the best we can do.
Yes. Well, it sounds like for the person who's interested in helping these lovely little creatures, habitat is the key, as it often is. And are you aware of any local resources for cat or for milkweed plants?
Yes, I am really happy to report you have some great resources up in the Panhandle. So I'm just going to kind of fire off a few options for people.
All right.
To be able to purchase either milkweed seed or established plants, you know, like seedlings or what's called root plugs. So Cedar Mountain Perennials in Ethel, they're a nursery they specialize in native plants for that inland northwest area. And I believe they have booths at the Sandpoint Farmers Market and maybe the Kootenai County Farmers Market.
They do.
And they grow both showy and a species called swamp milkweed, which is not native to the Panhandle, but if you had, you know, a really wet garden spot, it would grow well there.
Okay.
And Monarch loved both of those.
As we're wrapping up, I'm going to ask you to just go ahead and give us the names, and then we'll have to wrap it up.
You bet. Okay, Thorn Creek Native Seed Farm. They're in Genesee, which is a little south of you. Plants of the Wild. They're in Tequa, Washington. I think I said they're the city, right? And Pitkin Forest Nursery, which is at the University of Idaho, Moscow. They have amazing root plugs that will be available this September.
Well, Beth, thank you so much for coming on the show this morning and sharing your insights and your passion. We appreciate it.
Thank you both. It was really fun.
Yes, and thank you. This has been Beth Waterbury, recently retired wildlife biologist for Idaho Fish and Game, and we appreciate you spending the time with us. Thank you, Beth.
Yeah, thanks again for inviting me.